Good morning, everybody, and welcome back. Jailton Almeida put on a dominant, if somewhat lackluster, performance against Derek Lewis. I mean, to each his own. I've heard people say, oh, that wasn't like, it wasn't boring. But I love grappling. I mean, most of the breakdowns that I do on my channel are focused around grappling, and I thought that fight was boring as fuck. The only exciting moments, really, in the entire fight were moments where Derek Lewis almost got back to his feet or when he was stuffing a takedown attempt. I mean, other than that, it was a lot of Jailton Almeida just maintaining top control and laying on top of the person, which, don't get me wrong, top control is very important, and I do think the Otis is generally on the bottom person to get up, but I thought we could have saw a lot more activity from Almeida. Anyway, we'll get to that fight because I want to use it as a nice little like segue to talk about the state of the UFC's heavyweight division right now. And it'll kind of lend itself to talking about Ngannou versus Fury and the aftermath of all that as well, right? And the impact that could have on the heavyweight division and all of MMA really moving forward. So we'll get there. But first, let's just like kind of go down to the first fight on this card, Mark Jacaichi versus Cal Fernandez. I felt like when this decision got read, we were going to be in for a very long night of judging, especially with it being in Brazil, because for people to view this fight, like, people talk about robberies and how Francis Ngannou got robbed against Fury. That's not a robbery, right? There are a lot of close fights that aren't robberies. But if Fernandez was given the victory over Jacaichi in this fight, I would have considered it a robbery. I thought the first round was close, and I could kind of understand how you gave it to Fernandez if you're a person who really favors submission attempts. But ultimately, Jacaichi was the one dictating the pace. He took the fight to the ground. He was able to stay on top, and I just felt like he dominated most of the exchanges. The split decision in this one was crazy, and I really felt that it was going to set a precedent for the entire card. But I actually think you have to give a lot of credit to the judges. We shit on them a lot when they do poorly, but overall, they got a lot of the calls right in this one. Another one that I was kind of worried about when they read the decision, but they got correct, Angela Hill versus Denise Gomes. Usually Hill tends to be on the bad end of these decisions. She has really close fights where it seems like she may have won and the judges see it the other way. And you were kind of thinking with Gomes being a Brazilian opponent, I mean, you don't want your head to go there, but it does because you're in Brazil, right? And I kind of thought that they were going to maybe give a questionable nod to Gomes, but really the first round was the only close round in that fight, and Angela Hill just kind of ran away with things in two and especially in round three. So good win for Angela Hill, and good to see the judges getting that one right. I thought the 29-28 cards on that one were fair because the first round was competitive and Gomes was tagging her with some big shots, but overall. It's funny how you'll see themes kind of permeate themselves throughout the card. Like, one theme on this one that I thought we saw a lot was veteran experience. I thought it was important for, like, it showed a lot of fighters who struggled a little bit with that energy management, right? They kind of went in there against these older veteran fighters who were really good at that and struggled a little bit. But another one was the weight missing and everything. I can't believe how many fighters missed weight. And Eduarda Maura missing weight by 4.5 pounds in the 115-pound division is absolutely fucking insane. If you looked at her standing next to her opponent last night, Montserrat Conejo, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm going to butcher some of these. But if you looked at the two of them side by side, it looked like they were separated by maybe two weight classes. And that reason, and look what happened. Even though Conejo was faster and she got the better of that little initial exchange that they got into, she was actually the one that got the takedown. She ended up getting reversed, stuck on bottom, and then that's how the entire fight went. And that right there is why you saw Vince Pichel cancel his fight against Ismael Bonfim when he missed weight by 4.5 pounds. 4.5 pounds is a big weight miss in any division, but it is a massive, 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 massive weight miss at 115. Bonfim at least weighs 155. He weighed in at 159.5. This girl who just weighed in is halfway to her next weight class. She's at 120. She's almost fighting at the flyweight limit. If you're Conejo, you get into these weird situations where these fighters, they want to keep the fight because it's an opportunity for them to fight in the UFC. This is what they dream about. And they don't want to cancel it just because their opponent missed weight. But man, can't stress enough, Vince Pichel made the right call. And you got to think, Vince Pichel's a guy who's 40. He's not exactly a guy who is, you know, who's getting any younger. That had to be hard. That had to be a hard decision for him to make, knowing where he's at in his career, for him to turn that down. But it's the right thing to do. You need to start the way that you're going to eliminate this problem in part. A, the UFC should add more weight classes. I don't think most people that are in, you know, involved in the space or care about the space are debating that right now. But I really think that you need to have like rehydration clauses and stuff like that. But ultimately, the way to solve it for now is when your opponent misses weight, don't take the fucking fight. If you know for a fact that your opponent's going to cancel on you instead of taking the fight, that would solve the problem at least in part. But again, you're always going to have situations where fighters want to stay active and want to fight for the UFC and get their bouts in and get that name recognition for themselves out there. These are big opportunities for them. And I think their hands are kind of tied when they get into fights like this, especially if you're someone like Conejo. And I might be mispronouncing your name right now. It's not like you have a lot of star power, you know what I mean? So, man, if I was her, though, you're looking at an already big girl missing weight by that much. I don't know. I don't know if I would have taken that. Vitor Petrino versus Modestus Pekoskis. This was a great fight. I really felt like, honestly, Modestus Pekoskis was doing a good job of closing the range, right? He was getting in. He was either all the way in or all the way out, doing good with leg kicks. But then when the second round opened up, him coming in and kind of lunging in with those shots like that, Petrino timed it perfectly, hit him with the beautiful left hand, knocked him out cold, kind of out of nowhere. Your fight of the night might have been this next card, or this next fight here, between Renat Fakhretdinov and Eliza. Oh man, these names are going to kill me today. Zaleski Dos Santos. Eliza, I can never pronounce his first name right. Eliza Zaleski Dos Santos. But a great back and forth fight, and man, Fakhretdinov started off hot. I mean, he was tagging Dos Santos up, dotting him up everywhere, just looked really accurate with his punches, and maybe doesn't have, like they alluded to this in the commentary, maybe doesn't have that, like, if you were watching a silhouette of him throw strikes, you might not think it's the most technically clean, but because of his ability to mix in the wrestling, it really opens up that striking. You see that a lot with high-level wrestling guys. But I thought his striking looked good, but as the round, again, started to wear on, you saw the veteran in Dos Santos really start to get going and really fought his way back into that. Really, I mean, like, really battled back and got himself back into the fight. And the second round was a stronger performance from him, but I think he still lost. And the third was dominant. And I thought that, again, got to give credit to the judges where it's due. This was a great performance from Dos Santos, and like I said, a great way to battle back. And I thought that third round was definitely a 10-8. I thought that was justified. He hurt him to the body, nearly finished him, was on his back, about to choke him. I mean, he came as close to finishing Fakhretdinov as you're going to in a fight, I felt like. And just didn't. But it ended up in a draw. And again, I thought the judges did a really good job in getting that fight correct. So hats off to them. Like I said, we spend so much time criticizing them that I think it's important to also kind of highlight when they've had these good moments too, right? So we get to the main card, and again, you get another fight that's canceled. You find out that Petrosian versus Rodolfo Vieira is off, right? And I saw it said, like, the phrasing on it is odd, and I'd have to read the articles this morning to see if there's been any more info. But it said that Petrosian was poisoned. And what I'm guessing that means is he probably got food poisoning from something that he ate while he was down in Brazil, right? But either way, another fight off. So you've got three fights that are canceled already, I believe. You're down to an 11-fight card. Right before the main event starts, Petrosian versus Vieira is off, which is a matchup that I was really looking forward to, by the way. Great fucking fight. That one's off, so now you're down to a 10-fight card. And Elvis Brenner kicks things off against Krajewski. I'm telling you guys, I'm going to butcher these. I listened to it all last night, thought I had him down. They're gone. But Elvis Brenner, anyway, this was a competitive fight throughout the first few minutes as well. But man, that combination that Brenner landed was so simple and so clean, and it really just felt like it was going to be a glancing blow off the side of the head. But instead, he clipped Kynan right above the ear, knocked him out, and man, one of the cleanest knockouts that you've seen. Even though, like, I was thinking about this, this is one of those knockouts that make you think about how fragile the human, like, especially the human head is. There are so many ways that you can get dinged. Like, a lot of times you get hit on the jaw, right? Right on the temple, behind the head a little bit, like right back here, right here. Like, there are so many areas you can get caught in that put you out. And like I said, Yes, it was a beautiful setup. The way he stepped into it, slid his head off the center line, brought the left hand through. All clean as fuck. But it seemed like it was going to be just like more of a glancing blow. And instead, it put Krajewski out cold, face down on the mat, and one of the knockouts of the year so far. I mean, that's as clean a one-punch knockout as you're going to see. Other than Vitor Petrino's, I mean, two of them on the same fucking card. But a great performance either way from Elvis Brenner. Kyle Barallo versus Abus Magomedov. This was an interesting fight. And again, this one didn't really boil down so much to like the veteran experience versus the new guy coming in, really. But I do think it was an important fight to watch in terms of like energy management. Because if you watch Magomedov and his fight against Strickland, kind of came out burning pretty hot, right? Threw a lot of volume, was doing well against Strickland early. And in this fight against Barallo, it seemed like he was really measuring himself a little bit more, being a little bit more reserved. And when you do that, and you're typically a guy who likes to throw that volume and likes to get after it a little bit, it can also put you in this weird situation where now you're not throwing enough, the other person is getting ahead on the scorecards, and you still don't have that late burst in the third round that you thought you might have by reserving your energy. This is why energy management, despite the skill level of some fighters, can be such a hard thing to figure out. Because while you're not throwing, you're getting beat up, and that's still exhausting. So for Abus moving forward, I really feel that he has to figure out the energy management part of his game. I think he's very skilled, but I think that you saw him afraid to throw volume a little bit last night for fear of tiring out. And it ended up that he got tired anyway. So it's like, how do you strike that balance between throwing your hands around enough that you're winning rounds and threatening your opponent with things, but not gassing yourself out? And especially if you want to go fight in 5-round fights and try to challenge for the title and be a real contender in this division, that's something that you need to be capable of doing. And like I said, man, the skill is one thing, but when you get to the UFC, everybody is skilled. It really seems to be about energy management and picking and choosing your battles for when you're going to explode and take chances on things. But we just didn't see that from Abus. And Kyle Barallo also, super impressive. Super impressive. I mean, one of the more promising middleweights, his call out over Dricus du Plessis was absolutely fucking insane. He's not even ranked. But I do think you're going to see him maybe get somebody like a Fluffy Hernandez or one of those guys skating between like 12 and 15 in his next fight. But definitely, I mean, he came out, fought southpaw, fight, like stuck to a game plan, fought very well. I think Barallo is very talented. But man, we're not ready to see him fight somebody like Dricus yet, right? Like he's got a long, long way to go. But yeah, just made me think this fight more about energy management. And I think that it could have been a little bit more competitive had Abus actually not gotten so far away from what got him to the dance in the first place. Rodrigo Nascimento versus Dontel Mays. This was an interesting fight where, again, it was a heavyweight fight. It's a banger, you would think. But do you guys ever watch a fight? And I don't know how to explain it, but you can just feel it, whether it's in your gut or in your head. And sometimes you're wrong on it. Like sometimes a fucking flash knockout will happen out of nowhere. But you can just tell that this fight is not going to get finished and it's not going anywhere. And they're heavyweights, so things slow down a little bit. And every time they exchange, you are kind of like, oh. But like, man, I don't know what it was about this fight, but I just wasn't entertained by it. I thought Rodrigo looked really good. Mays had his moments as well. He did a good job fighting backwards and kind of countering. Had a great chin. He ate some big shots, but it just got this feeling that the fight was never going to finish or that nothing exciting was going to happen in it. Great win for Rodrigo Nascimento. Him and Almeida are, you know, some of the only fighters. There's only five, I think, Brazilian heavyweights on the roster for the UFC, and they're two of them. So big win for him, and he can keep climbing up the rank. And he looked good. Don't get me wrong. Nascimento looked good. He was putting pressure on him. I think he stayed very technically sound, you know, but man, just a fight where for whatever reason, it just didn't grip me. I don't know what was going on, but I don't know. Now, Gabriel Bonfim versus Nicholas Dalby, the next fight, complete fucking opposite. I was super entertained watching this fight the entire way through. I thought that Bonfim did exactly what we all thought he was going to do. Started very hot, very fast. And once again, guys, we're back to this, talking about these themes and stuff. We're back to this theme of load management that we just talked about with Abus. Right? Abus, whatever. When you're when you are fighting a veteran like Dalby, somebody who has, what, probably 30-plus fights. I think he's like 22 and 22. He's got to have close to 30 professional fights. He's 38 years old. He's finding success in the UFC. He's on a little bit of a tear right now. And granted, he struggled against Bonfim in that first round. People are also, we got to slow down. People are also being like, oh, Bonfim got fraud checked, blah, 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 blah. Again, when you see fights like this, it's not always just like, you have to look at Bonfim and realize that the skills are very clearly there. I mean, he has striking prowess. When he got the fight to the ground, the way that that man passes guard, he does not give you a whole lot of options to get your legs back in play. And you very rarely just get to hang out on the bottom and relax. I mean, he is constantly hitting knee slices and just getting around to side control, circling towards your head. I mean, he does a great job of advancing position when he's on the ground. And when you're on the receiving end of that and you have to constantly transition from here to here on the bottom, that is exhausting. And Bonfim does rely on technique. I think Gabriel Bonfim is incredibly skillful. But once again, so much in the UFC boils down to energy and load management. And Nicholas Dalby has a fucking endless gas tank. And when Bonfim, when things didn't go his way and he wasn't able to blitz him and get him out of there, you started to see. He started to fade a little bit. Dalby was still in his face, putting that pressure on him. And that starts to wear on you as the fight goes on. So, great performance from Nicholas Dalby. I mean, hats off to him. But all of these people who all of a sudden want to be like, oh, Bonfim got fraud checked. Like, man, are you sure? Or does he just have a few things to tweak and figure out? Because when I watch him, his skills are world class. That motherfucker, in terms of skill, can fight for a title. But it is not all about skill at this level. You have to be able to conserve yourself, pick your moments to explode. And I think that if Bonfim can develop that, he's nowhere near done with his UFC career. I think we're going to see this man return. And again, you got to be careful in your next fight that you don't get away from what got you to the dance. So many times when things like this happen to fighters, we see in their next fight that they're afraid to throw volume. They're afraid to throw things out there. You have to strike that balance, still be willing to get after it, but maybe dial it back just a little bit, right? So that you still have that energy heading into late round two and round three. But Nicholas Dalby, man, what a performance. You can't take anything away from him. He weathered a storm, stayed in the guy's face, took some damage, and just put it on him until he got him out of there. And then we get to the main event, Jailton Almeida versus Derek Lewis. And honestly, this fight kind of went the way I thought it was going to go. I thought that Almeida was going to have a hard time staying on the back and maybe getting the choke in. At first, I was like, when he got him down, I was like, eh, he might blitz through him. But the submission defense from somebody like Derek Lewis, really impressive. But also, the absolute lack of effort from the bottom from Derek Lewis, super unimpressive, right? Jailton Almeida, there were moments where he would get the takedown, and Lewis, the only exciting moments in this fight were moments where Lewis was defending the takedown or in certain scrambles where he almost got back to his feet. That was it. And I'm a fan of grappling, so don't sit there and tell me, oh, I was loving every minute of this fight. No, you weren't. And also people, I saw like, and not, I like Derek Brunson, I'm a big fan, by the way, but I just saw his Twitter this morning and he was like, I was on the edge of my seat waiting to see if Derek Lewis could get up. Were you? Because he barely tried to get up. I mean, there were moments where Lewis was literally just laying flat on his back, knees pointed toward the ceiling, and Almeida would step over and mount, and there was no attempt I'm not even talking like pushing on the hips, getting your, nothing. Absolutely fucking nothing from Lewis, laying there just dead while Almeida stepped in to mount. And I guess if you're Lewis, what difference does it make if the man's in side control or if he's in mount? But good Lord, I mean, there was no effort for him to try to prevent those mount takes. And I think that in those transitions, oftentimes, when the guy is going from side control into mount, that's when your best opportunities to escape are, right? So I don't know. I personally felt like the fight was boring. It was underwhelming. And I felt like Almeida could have done a lot more. I thought the commentators were right. I thought he could have done a lot more to really cement into your minds that this might be the next contender. And he didn't do that. Like, if he goes out and he just runs through Derek Lewis and finishes him in like a round or two, even three, even a finish at all, let's just say he gets him out of there. The fight against Ciryl Gane doesn't seem so unrealistic. But now that I just saw this, I want to see Almeida fight somebody like Curtis Blaydes, who he was originally slated to fight. I don't want to see him jump up and fight Ciryl Gane now. I feel like he's got a lot of things to work on the ground. Like, in terms of control, brilliant. Very hard to get off you. But again, it's not like Lewis is known for his necessarily his wrestling or his defensive jiu-jitsu. He just, like, is a big man that's hard to submit. And everyone's always like, oh, he's strong. Jiu-jitsu doesn't work on him. He understands the principles of jiu-jitsu enough and just of grappling enough to stay out of those submissions. Like, when Almeida's going for the arm triangle, right? If you let your elbow start creeping up above your head and get caved in like this, your shoulder's going to start cutting off the carotid. That's why you saw Lewis here and moving his elbow back over this way, right? Like, it's not, Lewis knows what he's doing from the bottom. He's just a little bit lazy from there until he finds moments to explode up. And Almeida is so good at controlling that those moments were very fleeting for Derek Lewis. And even if he did manage to mount some sort of defense and work his way back to his feet, Almeida just chained things together and took him down again. But you got to see a little bit more like initiative and willingness to try to finish the fight from Almeida, in my opinion. And now, like I said, I don't want to see him fight Gane. I want to see him fight somebody like Curtis Blaydes. Whereas meanwhile, if he would have blitzed through Derek Lewis, you start talking about those fucking different matchups, right? And again, great win for Almeida. And I think you've got a real problem on your hands in this division. But I also think that in this fight, we saw some things that we'd like to see cleaned up and maybe some improvements from Almeida. But this leaves us in a good spot to kind of start talking about the UFC's heavyweight division right now and just kind of the aftermath of Ngannou versus Fury and where this could all lead. So, where do we start with this? I haven't talked at all about Ngannou versus Fury, so let's start there. And let's start with the fight itself, right? So, very close fight, and Ngannou obviously put the entire world on notice. I think that he very arguably won the fight. I personally, people are not going to like this because I'm an MMA fan. Like, I primarily watch MMA, but I thought Fury won. I thought it was razor close. I didn't think it was a robbery, right? Like, if you go back and go through the rounds, I really felt like Fury won rounds 1 and 2. Ngannou won 3, obviously. I thought Fury rebounded nicely and took 4 and 5. 4 was very close, but I felt like Fury stung Ngannou with a shot that I felt like might have hurt him. Ngannou played it off well, but anyway, I gave 4 and 5 to Fury. I gave 6, 7, and 8 to Ngannou. 6, there was that illegal elbow. 7 and 8, I thought were pretty clear. And then 9 and 10, I gave to Fury. I thought it was tied up going into the 10th round. I thought it was about as close as you can get. So to call it a robbery, I don't think it's fair, but regardless of all of that, you got to look at what Ngannou just did. Man, he didn't just go out and fight and try to like knock Tyson Fury out. He went out and boxed Tyson Fury. I mean, he went out, he was switching stances. His footwork was nice. He was working the left hand. He was going to the body. He was playing with the lead hand of Fury, touching it constantly, looking for his shots. I mean, staying patient. And also, another thing that I really felt led to some of Ngannou's success was any time Fury would find a moment in the fight where he was able to tag Ngannou, he would go to follow up on it, and Ngannou would just sit in the pocket and fire back, and it kind of dissuaded Tyson Fury from following up on any of the successes that he was having in the fight. And that game-changing power, man, right there, that's when it can come in handy, because it kind of, I think, kept that attack of Tyson Fury at bay when things really could have started to escalate and get bad. And Ngannou just stayed calm, stayed composed, stayed in the pocket, and fired back. And I think that made Fury a little bit hesitant to keep following up with those shots. Ngannou also fought very well in the clinch. He did a lot of things right. I did a small, like, minute and a half breakdown on that. But overall, the significance of this really is that Ngannou proved to the world that you do not need the UFC as your promoter to go make money in this sport. Especially when you're at, like, you look at, like, Jake Paul fighting Nate Diaz, Ben Askren, Tyron Woodley, these retired guys who are going over, right, and don't have to deal with, they don't have to deal with all the contract stuff with the UFC, blah, blah, blah. But really, when you look at even Conor McGregor versus Floyd, the UFC was involved in marketing that. Dana White was at the press conferences pumping everything up, right? Like, he was involved. And Ngannou just showed that you can go and have a big, successful, legitimate event against the best heavyweight in the world. Not some scrub or celebrity boxer. The best heavyweight boxer in the entire fucking world. Many people argued of our generation up until that point, right? And performed the way he did. Like, Ngannou showed fighters that they can do it. And, you know, it's interesting because for so long, Dana has been afraid of the UFC heading in the same direction as boxing and getting watered down. And they're, that's why he doesn't want to add divisions. Meanwhile, by the way, this is a good time to talk about the state of the UFC's heavyweight division. Dana White doesn't want to add extra divisions because he thinks it'll make it hard for people to keep track of champions. It'll get watered down like boxing. The problem with boxing is not the number of divisions. The problem with boxing is the number of different organizations and the number of belts to keep track of and deciding what fighter is going to be fighting for what belt and blah, and keeping all that straight. Adding extra divisions is not going to be a problem under the same banner, right? Like, if you look at the UFC and what they're doing, Dana White complains about all of the boxing getting watered down. I don't want to add weight classes too much, blah, blah, blah. But then they hand out interim titles left and right. Like, Tom Aspinall versus Sergey Pavlovich this weekend should not be for an interim title. Even though they are probably, you know, behind Stipe, and like, they're obviously they are fighting for a number one contender series, a number one contender spot. That's what they're fighting for. It's not a belt. And the UFC just slaps this interim title on it so that it sells and looks good when they're selling the card. But really, you're confusing the fan base. I mean, whoever wins this fight next Saturday is going to get the interim title. And then they're not even going to fight John Jones, the undisputed champion, when he's healthy. John's going to fight Stipe. John needs 8 months to recover from shoulder surgery, which means you're probably, honestly, realistically, with how meticulous he is about all his recovery and stuff, you're probably not going to see him fight for a year. So the interim title is going to sit in limbo for a year while they wait for John and Stipe to fight and hash all that out. And then whoever wins that fight, let's say Stipe wins somehow, right? If Stipe wins, he's going to retire. So now you just got the interim belt sitting there. And if John wins, it's going to be another, if he doesn't retire after beating Stipe, which he might, it's going to be another 3 to 6 months before he fights the guy with the interim belt. So what are we doing here? Do you see what I mean? Like, you can't complain about inflating the number of champions and making blah, blah. You can't complain about all that and then just hand interim belts out left and right and expect everybody to track it. Even more interesting, back to all the Ngannou versus Fury stuff, is, like I said, Ngannou has paved the way for fighters now and made them realize that you don't necessarily need the UFC to make a lot of money in combat sports. And for so long, that hasn't been true. And for the first time, the UFC also cannot lay claim to having the baddest man on the planet on their roster. I mean, really, John Jones is in the same exact situation at heavyweight that Daniel Cormier was in at light heavyweight. Yes, you're the champion, but John never took the belt from Francis, the same way DC never took the belt from John. Francis is always looming in the background when you talk about the UFC's heavyweight division. And that doesn't matter so much in the lighter weight classes. For whatever reason, they don't get so much love. But Demetrius Johnson's also over fighting for one. And he might be the best flyweight in the world. But when it was just him, it didn't matter. But heavyweights matter, and people care about heavyweights, right? People do. Like, historically, it's the fucking, the largest weight classes tend to get the most attention. And with Ngannou doing what he just did, man, he brought a lot more attention to the sport and to himself as an individual. And now none of that attention is positively associated with the UFC. Anyway, my point is just, if you are an athlete like Sean O'Malley and you're on the verge of superstardom and you just won the title and you want to go box Devin Haney and the UFC's wagging their finger saying, no, 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 no. Or we want to be involved in this. We want this much of this. We want this much of that. You're going to start getting situations, in my opinion, where fighters aren't going to sign 3- and 5-fight contracts with the UFC. If they feel that they have a high potential for star power, they might sign 1- or 2-fight contracts. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think this is necessarily an overnight thing. But as more fighters start to get on that verge of superstardom and realize their net worth, they're going to want to explore these different avenues. And if the UFC isn't willing to play ball, man, we've been in a spot where for so long, the UFC has been thought about as the pinnacle of MMA talent. Like, if you don't have a UFC belt, it doesn't really matter. Like, yes, you could go win it in Bellator. Yeah, you could go win it in PFL. But if you don't hold the UFC title, you are not the best in the world. That's the public consensus on it. And all this stuff with Francis, we could be trending in a direction where that is no longer true. I think that when you look at the way that things are laid out, you could very easily be looking at fighters going off to different organizations, fighting different people for whoever's willing to pay them the most, not signing as long of contracts with promoters. And then ironically, Dana feared all this stuff with boxing. Now MMA is in the same boat, where nobody's really fucking sure who the best in the world is. Like right now, do you know for sure if John or Francis is the best in the world? No, you don't know. A lot of people assume Francis. Some will tell you John because he can wrestle, but there's debate. And the UFC, but the way to solve all this, if you're the UFC, in my opinion, long-term, if you want your company to be the best and remain the best and house all of the best talent under one roof, the only way is to go public with contracts and give fighters a much larger percentage of the revenue. The way things are structured right now, the UFC keeps all of the contract information that they sign with fighters private, and it's not left up to public scrutiny. This probably allows the company to benefit for now in the short term, but as things like this with fighters and athletes start to happen more, like, as they start to realize their own star power, you're going to get more and more of them going and chasing events like this in different promotions, like we mentioned. So the solution to that is simply to pay everybody. If you look at the NFL, NBA, MLB, all the contracts are public and the players are all well paid. And Dana White will also lie to you and tell you that in order for you to make your money in the UFC, you have to be a star. You have to be a Conor McGregor. And it's absolutely, in my opinion, a fucking bold-faced lie. If you look at the NBA, is LeBron James the most entertaining individual in the world? Absolutely not. But he gets a lot of media attention based strictly on his merit and his skill at basketball. The same thing with Mahomes. I don't think Mahomes is all that entertaining. He's not a Conor McGregor. He's not out saying outrageous shit, saying that he's going to come through like whoever he's playing that week's town, their favela, and slaughtering them. And like, you know what I mean? Like, he's not doing any of that. Conor was a wild man, and what he did was impressive for the landscape of the UFC. But moving forward, I really think that if you just start paying fighters their fair due, they would become superstars based on their merit. Because again, it would all influence each other, right? All of the money coming in, the fighters are happy with what they're getting paid. They don't feel this need to go chasing into other organizations. It allows them to market themselves better. Like, I'm pretty sure when you... It's also crazy that they tell you can't put sponsors on your shorts, which I agree with, by the way. I think it looks ugly. I think that if you want the sport to grow, again, look at the NFL, the uniforms. Uniforms are super important. But if you want to house all of the best talent under one banner in the UFC, the solution is fucking simple. You have to pay them. And if you don't pay them, your athletes are going to go somewhere else looking for their payday. You know what I mean? I really, like, you can debate all you want about we need to do this, we need to do that. Man, we're not going to see there is no doubt when you watch an NFL game who the best players in the world play for. They don't play for the fucking Canadian Football League, right? They play for the NFL. And right now, UFC's on this slope where, yes, that's still true for the most part, but it's certainly not true in the heavyweight division. And I don't think it's true at 125. And what if it becomes not true at 135 if they shut down O'Malley if he wants to box? I mean, man, it's going to be interesting to see how this shakes out. And I think for so long we've just viewed the UFC as this kind of like entity that can't be broken down or can't, it'll never lose. But man, if they don't make some corrections and get with the times, you could see a blockbuster situation end up here where they're really not invincible. But we'll see. I could be way wrong about all this, but I really believe the solution is just fucking pay them, make them. But the problem with that is the company will never do it. In reality, the athletes and the fighters have to unionize and demand that from the company. So it's going to be a long road, but man, I don't know. Next 10 years of MMA, I wonder how the landscape's going to look when we look at things in like 10 years. We'll see. But anyway, Thank you guys for listening to me ramble, especially towards the end there. I know I had a kind of a hard time circling around to the points, but yeah, you get it. Like, again, I can't get over how impressive the performance from Ngannou was and how much he really might have made a change in MMA. And he's going to have these ripple effects that run down through the heavyweight division and the rest of the sport. So yeah. Anyway, thank you guys for tuning in. Much appreciated as always. If you guys enjoyed, do me a favor, give it a like, subscribe, follow me. I have like 16 fucking Twitter followers. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, all that good shit. And yeah, appreciate y'all. Have a good Sunday. Bye-bye.